Yes.
Okay, we're on the record now. Okay, we're on the record now for OPA-PA-09-007 in the appeal of Guam Education Financing Foundation, Inc. It is approximately 9:26 a.m. We are on the sixth floor of the DNA building in Agana, Guam. In the DSIT conference room, I am Anthony Camacho. I'm the hearing officer for this proceeding. This is the hearing on the purchasing agency's motions to seal portions of the procurement record and for confirmation of substantial interest. Will the members of the Office of Public Accountability present today please identify themselves for the record?
Doris Flores Brooks, Public Auditor.
Lourdes Perez, Audit Supervisor. Ann Camacho, Admin Officer.
Thank you. Will the representatives for the appellant please identify themselves for the record? And please.
Thank you. I'm Phil Flores. I'm a member of the board of GIEF.
I'm Mike Alvarez, the secretary for GIEF.
Thank you, Mr. Flores. Mr. Alvarez, do you have any other institutional representatives present with you this morning?
We have none.
Okay, thank you. Will the attorney for the purchasing agency please identify himself for the record and any institutional representatives that are with him today? Could you please talk into the mic, Mr. Abrams?
My name is Benjamin Abrams, Assistant Attorney General.
Thank you. And we have one interested party who has made an entry of appearance in this matter. Will counsel for that interested party please identify herself and any institutional representatives with her today? And once again, Mr. Brunel, you can sit here at the table if you so desire, or if you're comfortable there, you're certainly welcome to remain in the benches at the back of the room. It's up to you. Before we begin, are there any, does either party have any witnesses for either the protective order, or the motion for the protective order, or the motion for substantial interest that are present in the conference room today? Could you please talk into the mic, Mr. Abrams? Thank you.
The purchasing agency has two witnesses present, and we represent. I will have one of those witnesses remain as the first witness to be called by us this morning, and then the other witness presented to the secretary.
Well, I'm going to ask that all the witnesses be sequestered at this time and be asked to leave the room until they're called, Mr. Abrams. Thank you. Mr. Abrams, have all your witnesses left the room? And also, just for the record, the parties and the public auditor and the hearing officer, we did have a sort of a off-the-record conference prior to going on the record, at which time we discussed the presence of two witnesses who erroneously appeared on behalf of the purchasing agency for OPA-PA-09-005. which I identified them to the council for the purchasing agency. Likewise, we also discussed kind of the order of these proceedings today, where we would start discussing merely the scheduling of the pre-hearing conference, and then we also discussed that we would proceed with the protective order hearing today, and then likewise the hearing on the purchasing agency's motion for confirmation of substantial interest. And we also discussed various evidentiary issues, preliminary evidentiary issues prior to going on the record. Now, pursuant to that discussion, we are going to begin with scheduling a pre-hearing conference in this matter. And as I stated, I know that the appellant is not represented by counsel, but just to explain the proceeding or the procedure, you are entitled to a hearing, a formal hearing in this matter, a formal hearing for your appeal. Likewise, the purchasing agency is also entitled to a formal hearing to decide your appeal. And preliminary to that formal hearing is what we call the pre-hearing conference. Now, it's at that time that we actually schedule the formal hearing in your matter, in this matter. We have the date of November the 9th, as I've discussed before we went on record, as the date for the pre-hearing conference in this matter. And I propose that we hold the pre-hearing conference on November the 9th, 2009 at 9 a.m. Is that date and time good for all the parties?
The date one more time, please.
November the 9th at 9 a.m.
That sounds fine to me.
I think that's fine.
Okay. And I know there was some discussion as to whether or not we would actually hold a formal hearing, okay? At that date and time, if all the parties waive the right to a formal hearing, okay, all of the parties have to, though, then we will not hold a formal hearing in the matter and decide your appeal based on the documents that have been filed, your agency report, the appeal itself, comment on the agency report, any rebuttals, so on and so forth, and of course, the procurement record in this matter. So that option is open to you, but if just one party, just so I can explain, I know you don't have a counsel with you, but even if you waive, for example, and the purchasing agency says, no, we still want a formal hearing, we have to hold that formal hearing. Okay? So all the parties basically have to waive a formal hearing if in order that we just decide the case on the record. Yes.
Is there a drop-dead date to say whether we waive it or not?
That date would probably be on the 9th of November.
Okay.
And the reason being is it's at that date and time that we will schedule that formal hearing. Okay. And, of course, please understand that when we schedule a formal hearing, of course, we have to submit, the respective parties will have to submit witness lists, various filings. There might be witnesses called. I, as hearing officer, would not appreciate a complete waiver of the formal hearing the day of the hearing, after all the witnesses have been inconvenienced to come down here, so on and so forth. It just would not be very responsible, nor would it be very cost-effective. Okay, so if we're going to waive a formal hearing, let's do so in a timely manner, okay, for all parties involved. And I ask parties to do that in good faith, okay? Any issues about that? Okay, so we're going to hold the pre-hearing conference in this matter on November 9th at 9 a.m., and I will issue a notice to that effect later today. The next item that is on the agenda is the protective order, and this is the purchasing agency's motion for a protective order. I do note that on October the 20th, the government waived oral argument and presentation of witnesses for just this motion. Is that correct, Mr. Abrams?
That's right, Mr. Commissioner.
Okay, and then Mr. Flores and Mr. Alvarez, do you have any witnesses that you would like to present for this motion, protective order motion?
For today?
Yes.
No, just my own statement that I'd like to read.
Okay, so that's a statement you'd like us to consider?
Yes.
All right. Mr. Abrams, do you have any arguments that you're going to make as this is your motion?
I would like to reserve some comments if the statement that is about to be read, in my mind, justifies that. So if we could keep that option open, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, so Mr. Flores, I'm going to... Okay, so my understanding then is that we will proceed with... I know the motion's already been filed. Your opposition has been filed. We're going to allow you to read your statement into the record. Is that correct? And then, Mr. Abrams, you'll be allowed to comment on that?
Fine.
Ms. Tang, same thing. Would you comment on that as well?
Thank you.
Okay. So we're going to proceed then with the appellant's comments or oral opposition, oral arguments regarding the purchasing agency's motion for protective order. Please proceed, Mr. Flores.
Okay. And thank you for your patience with me. I'm not an attorney, but I was almost a notary public once. Rick is off island. He's in Atlanta. He could be here with us either in person or on the telephone, but he is having surgery today. The Office of the Public Auditor has stated its mission is to achieve independent and nonpartisan assessments that promote accountability and efficient, effective management throughout the government of Guam. We seek to serve the public interest by providing the government of Guam, the Guam legislature, and the people of Guam with dependable and reliable information, unbiased analysis, and objective recommendations on how best to use government resources in support of the well-being of our island and its constituents. In this matter, GEEF's objective is to help OPA to achieve its mission. We are seeking to bring out dependable, reliable information. We expect that OPA will render unbiased analysis and objective recommendations on how best to see the people of Guam are getting the best value for their money. We offer our information and testimony in the hopes that the public auditor will evaluate the proposed school to be built by IBC and the proposed cost and evaluate whether it represents the best value compared to the school proposed by GEEF. In response to the motions being heard, GEEF is opposed to the purchasing agency's motion to seal portions of the procurement record, and GEEF is opposed to the purchasing agency's declaration of substantial interest. Our specific arguments in support of our positions are, first, with respect to the motion to seal portions of the procurement record. At this point, GEEF has provided evidence of IBC's cost and scope of work based upon the preliminary official statement issued by GEA on their behalf. We understand the gravity and importance of the truthfulness in official statements and the public disclosures as required by the SEC. We understand that it is the agency's position that the official statement is inaccurate and the procurement bid documents are more accurate in terms of disclosing costs and scope of work proposed by IBC. This information is exactly what is at issue in connection with GEEF's protest and appeal, and GEEF's ability to defend its position is significantly limited without access to this information. GEEF does not have any way to verify the size the school IBC is proposing, except from publicly available information, since DPW will not disclose the information, deeming it confidential. GEEF believes in transparency and has no objection to fully disclose all of the information in each proposal so every stakeholder can access the value derived from the dollar spent. GEEF does not understand why the size of the school should be confidential, since the school to be built should be public knowledge and not considered confidential. If the motion to keep information confidential is upheld, then GEEF must rely on the OPA to accurately assess the plans of IBC's proposal and determine if the comparison of GEEF is accurate or not. The OPA's mission also states that OPA will perform our work with diligence, conscientiousness, and due professional care. We assume whoever is reviewing the plans for OPA is knowledgeable about reading plans and calculating the square feet of enclosed space, since the cost to construct a building is significantly more than the cost of covered walkways and a covered pavilion. Further, the annual rental cost to the Guam Department of Education due to IBC is one of the most relevant factors, and as we stated earlier, IBC's additional rent is significantly higher than GEEF's. We respectfully request that OPA to disclose who and what analysis they intend to perform in judging the appropriateness of GEEF's appeal. Furthermore, Geith believes that more, not less, public disclosure is generally in the best interest of all and in the promotion of a fair and equal process. Therefore, Geith is opposed to the motion to seal and is willing for DPW to disclose all portions of Geith's proposal, provided it discloses such information for all proposals. The information has been disclosed in the official statement in connection with the financing. If an open and transparent process is to be followed in connection with its appeal, Geith does not see how or why the size and design of the school to be built must be kept confidential. While Geith assumes that the OPA will have access to this information, will accurately access it, we also believe a public school should have, the public should also have access to see how their dollars are spent.
Yeah.
I have further language on our opposition to the purchasing agency's declaration of substantial interest, but I wait on that, or do you want that now?
No, we'll discuss that at the next
okay.
motion.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Mr. Abrams, any response?
Very briefly, we go back to the fact that the RFP called for sealed bids. This is a sealed bid project. That's a starting point, and I really believe that's the ending point, because what we have here is a ranking, and we have negotiations that may lead to an award and may not. And those negotiations are just as confidential as the proposals themselves. As this forum has already ruled in granting the motion for a protective order in the companion protest appeal. If this were put out for rebid and we opened everything up the way that Mr. Enman and Mr. Torres feels we should, this would present a clean rebid. And of course, these points were covered in our submittals, and they were also covered in the ruling that came out yesterday. So I have very little else to say. Thank you so much.
Ms. Tang, do you have any comments?
Thank you.
All right. Remind the parties, please speak into the microphone so we can preserve your argument for the record.
Picking this up? Okay. Thank you. We won't, re-argue what we argued earlier, except as stated in the papers. Once again, this is a selection. They're protesting the selection of IBC. There has not been an award. And the decision of the OP is very quick. There's no award. It is the proposals are not subject to disclosure in the ground law. I will respond to Mr. Foy, the guest's comments regarding transparency and the need to know what IBC's numbers are. One of the biggest components of this proposal is the construction cost and the details relating to that. And if in a scenario where you have three different contractors, three different bidders, I think, you know, that's a great argument. That may be a good argument. But where you may have one contractor for two of the proposers who happen to be possibly the protesters, I think that transparency argument doesn't really, misses the point. I mean, I think the transparency, they're asking for information regarding IBC, but a lot of the information relating to the construction cost is readily available to those proposers. I don't know if this is true, but there are discussions or talk on the street that the contractor for both the rank number two, GF and GCF, are the same. If that's the case, then transparency doesn't really make sense because they have the information. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take the purchasing agency's motion for protective order under advisement. That's just a fancy legal term of art, meaning we're going to consider it and issue a decision later, not
okay.
at this time. Okay. The next item on the agenda is the hearing for the purchasing agency's motion to confirm substantial interests. And just to explain this motion to the appellant, due to the fact that the appellant is not represented by a legal counsel, This is quite a substantial motion. If the public auditor confirms the purchasing agency's declaration of substantial interest, the end result will be that the purchasing agency will be allowed to proceed with awarding the contract despite the protest. It will not end the protest, but the contract will be awarded, and it may substantially affect what remedies the appellant would have if the contract's awarded and then they subsequently prevail on their appeal. So I do understand that Mr. Flores, Mr. Alvarez. I think this is the second time I've explained it, but I'll explain it again. In any event, as we were discussing before we went on record, we're going to have witnesses for this. Is that correct, Mr. Abrams?
Two witnesses, yes, Mr. Camacho.
Okay, and I know that Mr. Flores, Mr. Alvarez, you only had that written statement you were going to read into the record?
Yes, we had it in the statement.
Okay.
But no witnesses.
But no witnesses, okay. And so what we'll do is, are you still going to put on those witnesses today, Mr. D?
That's correct, Mr. Camacho.
Very well.
We're ready to go.
Ms. Tang, do you have any witnesses?
No, thank you.
All right. Well, we are then going to follow the schedule set forth in the October 9, 2009 scheduling order in this matter. We're going to begin with the, as this is the purchasing agency's motion, we're going to begin with the purchasing agency's opening statement. Will be followed by the interested party IBC's opening statement. Mr. Flores, that is where you'll have your opportunity to give your opening statement, okay, which I believe will be your written statement. And that will be followed by the purchasing agency's presentation of evidence. So what that means is that's when they're going to put on their two witnesses, okay. The way that works essentially is they will conduct a direct examination of each witness. Each witness will be sworn. There'll be a direct examination by Mr. Abrams of each witness. The interested party, who, correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Tang, is somewhat aligned or may have joined with the purchasing agency's motion. Is that correct?
Yes.
Will then give their comment and do a somewhat of a direct exam as well. You will have the opportunity to cross-examine each witness. Okay?
Okay.
And we'll do that for each witness, each of the two witnesses. At the end of that, the purchasing agency's presentation of evidence, we'll have the interested party's presentation of evidence, but she states she has no witnesses. Then you will have your opportunity to present any witnesses that you so desire. When that process is done, we'll then go to the closing statements. Okay, same order, purchasing agency first, interested party second. And the appellant will go last. And then finally, because it is the purchasing agency who has the burden of going, or basically the burden of proof, it's their motion, they will have a brief rebuttal, okay, after all the closing statements are done. Okay, do you understand that process?
Pretty much.
All right, very well. And just a couple of technical issues. As we stated to the parties off the record, the reason I know that we've been having the purchasing agency and the interested party seat on the right side of the room, and the appellant seat on the left side of the room. The reason that switched today, it's not a shell game. The reason is we anticipated a teleconference with Mr. Inman back in Atlanta, Georgia, and unfortunately the teleconference equipment would not fit or would not reach the other side of the room. So that's why we had anticipated the just the teleconference today, but because we have Mr. Flores and Mr. Alvarez physically present, we did not have time to reconfigure the room. That's why there's a little difference in where the parties are seated today. Likewise, we've only got 3 working microphones, okay? So the parties will have their microphones, but unfortunately, the hearing officer's microphone and the public auditor's microphone we will use for the witnesses, okay? So we will make do with what we have and go forward with these proceedings. Okay. Do we have any questions about that? All right.
Okay, here we go. Can you touch your microphone, Mr. Evans? We just have to switch the mic. All right, they work. I'm just going to hold this. Okay, so we will begin with the purchasing agency's opening statement. Mr. Evans?
Thank you, Mr. Camacho, and thank you, Ms. Brooks. I'm just going to hit the highlights here a little bit because we developed this pretty well in the companion case, and we've submitted our argument in writing in this case, so I don't have a whole lot to say, but I find it irresistible to comment that there are 2 costs and 2 expenses involved here. The cost of the project is a substantial interest in going forward, because the taxpayers of Guam need to economize. You know, time is money. It starts and stops with that. How many times have we all heard time is money? In this case, money is time and time is money. If we burn up the clock with the appeals while there's a freeze on this project that was the subject of emergency legislation, that seems to be at variance with the substantial interest nature of this. And after all, what is substantial, as in substantial interest? You just flip open any dictionary and you will find, not in a law dictionary, but Webster's, for example, you're going to find that substantial is not frivolous, it's of substance. So is this an issue that's of substance? We freeze this any longer, construction costs are going to go higher. We've all heard about the takeoff in the economy, the construction boom that hasn't really happened yet, but we see that it's starting. And when all this happens, there'll be shortages of materials. There'll be more expensive materials. There'll be labor shortages. And the longer we hold this up, even if there wasn't some sort of construction boom about to happen to Guam, the natural percolation of these, the cost of these matters, labor and materials, is always up. I never heard much about things getting cheaper. Things always get expensive, more expensive. So there's the cost to the taxpayers in delaying this. But the real cost is to the students of this island. And in enacting the adequate education bill by then Senator Klitsky, we see that the education of our students is the number one priority, not a number one priority, but the number one priority. What could be more substantial than that? And the last thing I would like to say about it is that unless the purchasing agent, in making his determination of substantial interest, committed some kind of obvious mistake or miscalculation, if there was something on the face of Mr. Perez's determination of substantial interest that was glaringly inaccurate, for example, or fallacious, for example, if there was something on the face of it that didn't look right, fine, don't confirm it. But I think a confirmation of his determination of substantial interest should always be given, absent any kind of obvious flaw in either his determination or the basis for that determination. So with those three points having been addressed again, I have nothing further. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Abrams. Ms. Tang, you have an opening statement.
Thank you. The PDF case, the specific data system case, is directly on the site of that award. And in that case, the court found that confirmed substantial interest for her to score for the procurement involving the purchase of computers. And the court just sort of found that there was substantial interest in doing that. This is, that was just computers. We're talking about the school here. We're talking about kids who went to double session. We're talking about kids at school that can move blocks of medication. All this information was addressed in the earlier hearing. So I won't repeat what we argued earlier, but I think that there's certainly sufficient, more than adequate common ground for confirming the agency's determination of potential interest. Lastly, with respect to the cost of interest of going up, that's a real, real concern for me. Since last term, I've heard from several contractors that the federal government is, I believe it's going to award or either bid or award a huge, either hundreds of millions of dollars contract, federal contract in March. And what happens when that happens is the resources get tied up. Cost of construction for the local projects will go up. This is a real instrument that we ask that you confirm the agency's funding for substantial determination so that the project can
continue. Thank you. Mr. Flores, Mr. Alvarez, you have the floor for your opening statement.
Thank you very much. I'm glad the opposing counsel, what do I call you?
Opposing counsel.
Okay. Yeah, we keep bringing up the issue of money and things going up and getting more expensive, because that's really what our argument is based upon here. The purchasing agency is requesting to essentially set aside the appeal process and move ahead with the IPC project, notwithstanding the appeal process, under the argument that time is of the essence and the appeal is not worthy of due consideration. We respectfully disagree. First of all, the government of Guam has signed a long-term lease agreement for temporary space for the JFK students to alleviate the immediate need for school space. The government has committed to this space at a great expense to Guam, and as we understand it, cannot be canceled if the new JFK opens in the next 12 months. Therefore, the urgency to start construction is less than it was when the RFP was originally issued. Furthermore, if time is of the essence, why has it taken the procurement office 7 months to negotiate and close the financing? If this process has taken 7 to 8 months already, and it seems prudent to spend a couple of weeks figuring out why the government is paying $41 million to $70 million more to build JFK. If the process can save GovGuam $70 million, the savings seem substantial and worth taking the time to verify the process. According to the official statement, IBC is proposing to build a school about half as large as GEEPS and that will not meet DOE's needs for the current JFK population. No wonder its bid was cheaper initially. But through the negotiation process, IBC's bid increased from $38 million to $69 million. Now IBC is proposing to spend $11 million more than GEEF to build a much smaller school. GEEF's bid was to build a 236,000 square foot school for $58 million compared to IBC's proposal to build a 144,000 square foot school for $69 million. If GEEF builds a 144,000 square foot school, our in cost would be $42 million, $27 million less than IBC's. IBC's cost per square foot is $479 per square foot, nearly double GEEF's $245 per square foot. In fact, GEEF could deliver the same school IBC is proposing and would still have enough money left over to build three more elementary schools. Why did the negotiations with IBC continue when its cost increased to 50% more than another bidder? IBC's proposed 30-year financing makes the difference worse when compared to GIEV's 20-year financing. Assuming the same interest rate and work scope, IBC would require total payments of $83 million more over the 30-year term than GIEV. The agency has argued that it does not need to look at the bids as cost on a cost per square foot basis or other side-by-side basis. But we propose that is exactly what OPA or someone in charge of defending the public trust should do. Compare on price per square foot basis, compare the sum of the lease payments over the term of the deal, assuming the same interest rate for a side-by-side comparison of cost, as it appears that some participants in the process are trying to obscure the facts versus disclosing the facts. Further, when we reviewed the POS once more in the review process, it also stated that IBC is still charging $1.8 million a year in, quote, additional rent to maintain and insure the school. That is $1.2 million more per year, or almost three times what GEF was proposing to charge to provide maintenance and insurance to the school. So IBC's rent payment will be much higher than GEF's with this vastly higher additional rent number. This additional rent will cost GovGuam an additional $36 million versus GIEV's proposal over the life of the deal, in addition to the higher costs GIEV has already noted. Why would the committee agree to the extra expense? Given the materiality of these numbers, it seems imprudent to brush aside this appeal and move forward with IBC notwithstanding the appeal. Finally, we highly doubt that any underwriter can close financing with an unresolved appeal pending anyway. So granting DPW a right to proceed while the appeal is underway will not speed the closing of the financing at all. As stated earlier, GEF is opposed to the purchasing agency's declaration of substantial interest.
Mr. Flores, I just had one question on that. Is that the identical statement that you filed in your opposition?
I don't know.
You don't know. Okay.
No.
Okay. Yeah, is there any way that you could possibly submit that argument, a copy of that for the record?
What I'm presenting today?
Yes, correct.
Absolutely.
Okay, and you'd also have to provide copies to the opposing counsel as well.
We got them.
Okay. All right, thank you. Mr. Abrams, who's been chomping at the bit, so to speak.
I can hardly restrain myself.
Your rebuttal, sir.
I have a few things to say about that, what I just heard from Mr. Flores. With all due respect, the last thing he said was, I tried to write it down real quick, to the effect that if substantial interest determination is confirmed, that won't enable IBC to go out and get financing because there's an appeal pending. Well, there are two sides to that. First of all, that's conjecture. As skillful and competent as experienced as Mr. Flores no doubt is in the banking world, and he speaks with some authority on that matter because he is one of the top bankers on the island. But still, it's rank conjecture to speculate that with appeals pending, it would not make sense to confirm substantial interest because it wouldn't make any difference. IBC couldn't get the financing. If IBC, one thing's for sure, if substantial interest is not confirmed, IBC certainly can't get the financing. Only by letting the procurement process go forward will IBC have a chance to do that. And while I'm on that subject, it benefits Mr. Inman's client, GEFF, to have the determination of substantial interest confirmed by the public auditor, and here's why. Because if he's right, and IBC is unable to get the financing because of any reason or because of the appeal pending, guess what happens? They have a finite window. It's not that the purchasing authority is going to give IBC a year and a day to do this. There's a definite window. I'm not sure what it is, but it seems to me like it's 30 days or maybe 40 days, something like that. Don't hold me to it. But the point I'm trying to make is there's definitely a certain period within which IBC has to step up to the plate and deliver the goods. If they don't, guess what happens? It goes to GESF. They're the number two ranked bidder. If I were in Mr. Flores' shoes, I wouldn't be sitting up here asking the public auditor not to confirm substantial interest. If I were Mr. Flores, I'd be begging you to do it. Because if he's right, and he does speak with authority, as soon as IBC is bumped out of the way, they step into the spotlight. And I'm sure with all of the banking expertise and experience that Mr. Flores brings to the equation, he will be successful in putting a finance deal together for GEFF where IBC couldn't. So it's actually in Mr. Flores' interest, in GEFF's interest, to retract everything he just said and join us in asking the public auditor to confirm Sam's purchase. Now I'm sure he will as soon as I put this mic down. The other thing that he said, and of course Mr. Flores is A, new to this protest appeal in terms of actually participating, and B, the banker that he is, he's no lawyer, he's a layman. And when he says that if the public auditor confirms determination of substantial interest, it will be brushing the appeal aside. Those are his words. That's hardly the case. It will not be brushing the appeal aside. It will double track. At the one time, on the one hand, it will allow the purchasing authority to go ahead and let IBC do what they can do. Okay? The double track, the other track is the appeal process will go forward. And the merits of these appeals will be determined. If the merits of the appeal are determined the way Mr. Flores seems to think they will be, then his company stands a second chance of getting what they want out of this, because they're the second-ranked bidder. So the appeal's not going to be brushed aside, contrary to what Mr. Flores said. Now, Mr. Flores was agreeing with me to a certain extent that the financial consideration in determining in confirming the determination of substantial interest is relevant. However, Mr. Flores seems to think that the substantial interest determination should not be confirmed because since IBC is so expensive and GEFF is so cheap, that IBC should not be allowed to proceed. Well, here's why Mr. Flores is wrong. In the initial, I'm not going to comment on what I feel are proprietary figures that should be under seal. It should be protected. It was protected in the other case. We still don't know in this case. But what I think is safe to say is, for sure, IBC's original price tag was lower, significantly lower, than GEFF. There is no question in my mind about that. What happened after they were ranked number one is this. They were entering into negotiations with GovGuam and the purchasing agency in GEDA. And during those negotiations, certain things were requested by the government, such as amortization over 3 years. Mr. Flores is right. Again, as a banker, he well knows this, that it's going to be more expensive to spread this over 3 years or over a number of years instead of 1 year. But as the governor has pointed out in a letter I saw in the file, this, although the interest rate is higher when you spread it over a number of years, the budget of GovGuam is not so infinitely large that it can accommodate a payment in 1 year instead of, say, 3 years. So it's better to spread it over 3 years because even though the interest rate is higher, GovGuam can handle it easier for a number of reasons. So that's why it was spread over the 3 years. And the same thing would happen if GEFF had entered into those. Let's say they were the number one ranked bidder and their original bid quote was subjected to the negotiations that IBC's was. And their price tags won't go up too. So it's unfair for GEFF to say, "Well, my gosh, IBC, after they were ranked number one, their price tag kept going up." First of all, I don't know how he has access to that information because that's supposed to be protected. But even if he's assuming he's right, that would have happened to any other bidder who had been selected instead of IBC, because of the negotiations that went on were the reason for any higher price by IBC, and that's pretty obvious. I think I have one more point to make. No, I think I've covered everything that I had to say on that. So unless Ms. Tang has anything, I'm ready to call my first witness. Thank you.
And Mr. Fuller, in case you're wondering, it's at the closing argument you can address anything that you disagree with in terms of any of the direction I recant. No. I'm saying is so it's a closing argument that that
you know this is a real serious matter. I have to tell you, I am really enjoying it because I'm learning a lot.
Okay. All right. And the next. Okay, but it's Mr. Abrams' motion. So as a point of order, it's Mr. Abrams who has the last word in his rebuttal this time. Okay. And you can reserve that for your closing. Okay. All right. As it is the Purchasing Agency's motion, Mr. Abrams, your first witness, please. And please bear with us. We also have to do this mic transfer here. Okay.
Please state your full name for the record.
Yes, my name is... Full name, the
person.
Okay, is that good? My name is Dana Sedarian.
How do you spell Dana?
Dana, D-A-N-A, like Anna with a D, Dana Sedarian. F as in Frank, I-G-I-R-L-I-Y-O-N-G. That would be fun. I can't say it right either. Everyone calls me Mrs. Fig.
Okay,
or
would you prefer to... Yeah.
That's fine.
Good morning, Ms. Figuer-Leon.
Good morning.
Where are you employed, Ms. Figuer-Leon?
I am a science teacher at John F. Kennedy High School.
Where is that located, please?
At the moment, it's over on the teaching facility.
And for how long have you been teaching there?
At John F. Kennedy in general, even the school itself.
At the one at Teejin?
At the one at Teejin, since it opened in, was it August, whenever we started school.
And where did you teach before the JFK at Teejin?
Before that, I taught at George Washington High School for JFK at that campus.
And before that?
Over at the Tumon campus.
JFK
Tumon campus, yes.
So you've been a JFK teacher through all of the tribulations?
Oh, yes. I've been there about 25 years now.
25 years?
Yes.
Okay. Now, how are things teaching-wise at the temporary teaching facility where JFK is currently located?
For my class, completely, totally inadequate.
Why do you say that?
I teach chemistry. My classroom is not even half the size of my lab room at JFK in Tumon. There are no, the lab stations that they're put in, the tables, there's enough space. If I have put my students around to accommodate no more than 18, and even that, it is not really safe for, because it's so narrow and so cramped, it's not safe in terms of movement of the students. There's no gas lines that have been put in, and I've been fighting to get that put in.
Could I stop you, just to interrupt, excuse
mm-hmm.
me, but on the safety issue, when you say that the classroom is unsafe, and you said something about movement, let's take this one at a time. Let's talk about the hazardous nature that we were referring to when you said it was unsafe. Now, how many students are in this classroom?
I have 28 students each day.
And would you be able to give the public auditor an idea of how big the classroom is physically? Like, is it 15 by 20 feet, or what would you say?
It's about 18 and a half feet wide, and I think I counted off about 45 feet long.
So it's a rectangular shape?
Yes, narrow rectangle.
All right. Now, you said that there was a safety issue here. Would you just be more specific about what that is?
All right. I teach a real chemistry class. There's one engineer who oversaw Ukadu said to me, that means my students use Bunsen burners. They use acids, they use concentrated acids in their labs, they use a lot of poisonous chemicals. The equipment is put out, and it has to be put out in an area for them to access for the particular labs, like when they go over to, say, to a burette to take out, to drain out, say, 3 milliliters of this acid or that. There's going to be movement in the classroom, and that means they're carrying these liquids then back to their station to do the lab with it. So there's a danger there, because every time students are passing and there's not enough space, you're likely to bump, you know, someone else turns around and someone's behind them, things get knocked, glassware gets broken, people could, you know, get cut. The labs are real. It's all I can say is that they're not Mickey Mouse. And it's just, as I told my students many times, would you want to go to the hospital and have a doctor operate on you to take your tonsils out, and they've never even cut on a human being before, on a cadaver? I teach them, I prepare them to go on to the universities to become our future doctors, dentists, nurses, architects, engineers, forensic chemists, all these careers that need chemistry.
With the size of the classroom, the physical dimensions that you just estimated for us. Thank you. Would the size of the classroom render it more dangerous than a larger classroom in the event of an earthquake or a fire and they had to be in evacuation?
Oh, definitely. That is another issue. Like, the room is so narrow, even if I had just 18 students back there, if there was a child who spilled acid, they got something on their face, the hair caught on fire, something's wrong, for me to physically get to them, all these other bodies are going to have to move aside to even get to them, and, you know, to get to them quickly, to help them, to get them over, to deal with whatever it is. the room is just too small to function.
Let's say there was a fire. How would that be handled?
Well, first of all, right now, the fire extinguisher is outside my classroom door in the hall. And if I were to go outside that door to grab the fire extinguisher, the door will close behind me and it locked. I cannot unlock from the outside that door handle. So I don't even have immediate access to go back into the room. I would have to stop and unlock the door. But just to get over to the area, to get the students out of there, you know, if there's really a fire, kids are going to be panicking, they're going to start pushing. I mean, it's just very cramped. It's just too cramped to do what needs to be done.
Do you have enough equipment?
I have enough equipment for my classes in terms of if I have it all together with me, but I don't have it all at Teason.
Where is it?
At the moment, over half of it's over at JFK in Tumon, stored still.
Why is it over there?
Because I have no place to put it. There's no facility. The rooms that they've even given me at the Teason facility are very small, and I just brought in, I had all summer a room in my home filled with stuff from my labs because there was no place to put that safely over the summer. And equipment that was very expensive that we felt it was safer to have them in the home than to put them in an abandoned school building where there's more likely to be a break-in. So there's no place for me to put this stuff over at Teason if I were to move it over there. I need an air-conditioned room. The storerooms are not air-conditioned. There are no counter spaces. There are no sink facilities in the store, no washing. I am working with highly concentrated acids when I prepare solutions. If any of you have worked with muriatic acid, which you can buy in the hardware store, the acids I work with to prepare labs are four times as concentrated as that. I have to have facilities of water, so if there's a spillage, then I can immediately take care of it and protect myself as well and clean up whatever has been contaminated.
Do you have enough sinks? Thank you. Do you have enough sinks? Is there enough, are there enough water outlets in the classroom?
There are no sinks right now in my classroom.
No.
There are cabinets where there are holes that they plan to put sinks into. If my understanding is that they ordered the same equipment that they have for Ukadu High School, and I have been to the Ukadu lab, and the sinks are too small for chemistry. They're not made to put glassware underneath the faucets to wash. There's not enough sinks, no. Not for 28 students.
Do you have any sinks?
Not at the present. There are water lines, but they have not been hooked up to the sinks. The sinks have not been put into the cabinetry.
Well, how can you teach chemistry in labs without sinks?
I'm not. What I'm having to do right now, we basically have been doing labs with density labs, things that have not been basically using water right now.
So, am I correct then in understanding that there's a truncated educational experience because of the lack of sinks and maybe other equipment too?
Oh, definitely. My room, there is no way I can do the labs that I was able to do at the Tumon campus with the students at the teaching facility.
What about at GW? How was it there?
GW, for me personally, was better.
How?
Because it was a full-size lab. And the GW campus did not use the facility at all. Their chemistry classes were in other rooms rather than the chemistry classroom. So the lab facility was mine to use. I was able to put in gas, you know, by another. The gas lines were there and actually operational because we still had the gas, I believe, from when I had in 2002 after Paul Saint-Wall. And I replaced the tank when it got empty. The lines are there. There's sinks. We got the sinks repaired at GW that were leaking. The electrical lines are operational. The classroom is huge. Plenty of space for 28 students to function. One of the things they did at Teason, they, let me explain this. At GW, the counters are in like sections of 12 feet long lab tables with sinks on one end and water troughs in between. What they have at Teason for me are 6 feet tables, but they separated it 12 feet. The two of them makes 12, but they separated it by putting a cabinet in between. It has two sinks. So by doing that in the middle, I cannot put four people, two partners, in that 6 foot space. If I had a whole 12, I could line up more students along that table. But now, because of the way they've cut it in the middle, it's not functional.
What about gas lines in your chemistry lab at the teaching?
There are no gas lines. And there is no hood system to remove the fumes. And yet, on the material that I have been shown, the paperwork, it says very explicitly, physics and chemistry classrooms like the chemistry room at UCADU. UCADU has gas because I spoke with the manager of that project. She came to JFK to see my room and take pictures. And she showed me the layout, what they are doing. I said, well, where are the gas lines? Oh, we didn't put any in. Where's the eyewash? Oh, there isn't any. Where's the hood system? Oh, we don't have any. I said, how can you teach chemistry if you don't have these things?
Well, what about the fumes from all over? Are you working with hydrochloric acid?
They will be if I get a facility that's ISO safe to use.
But right now you...
Oh, no. No. It's because if anything happens, I don't even have water. The only water nearby is the restroom, the teacher's restroom or the student's restroom in the cafeteria, which is sometimes locked.
Have there been any mishaps, any accidents, any injuries until now?
No, because what we've worked with is just basically water, razors, marbles, you know, things that I know the students aren't going to get hurt with.
So, if I understand correctly, to avoid any kind of risk of injury or hazards, you have compromised the scope of the educational experience so that the children are studying less and experiencing less in a lab environment than they otherwise would, because it's just too dangerous to do the other things. Is that correct?
Definitely. Even if they fix up the facility that they're planning, it still won't be big enough for all 28, nor wide enough even for half the class at a time to function.
Are you talking about planning at the new school or planning at the Teason school?
No, the Teason school.
Oh, okay.
The new school, from what I haven't seen the final drawings, but I personally contacted the architect, because after going to UCADU and seeing what they did there, like they put in tables for the students, and it's the same thing they put into my room right now, the tables are the height for you to sit at. You cannot have a child sit down. They're working with Bunsen burners. They're working with acids. Something spills. That takes time for them to stand up instead of just being able to move back. It's dangerous. They've got to be higher. They're not the right height for lab stations. So I contacted the architect, and they've come over several times to JFK. We took measurements. And they told me that they would design it according to what I wanted. But I have not seen the final plans.
Okay, thank you. Getting back to the existing facility, are you able to use the software that you would like to use to educate these?
No. You know, JFK recently, it came out about our HiSET 10 scores. In the science area, we are above the national average. Above the national average.
What?
In science, in terms of the skills that our children have in their school. That happens because of what we do in the classroom. The experiences, the learning experiences our children experience. I do not believe in being a teacher. I'm not a teacher that's going to stand here and say, today we're going to learn about density. Now watch me weigh this. Oh, the balance says this. Now, here's the graduated cylinder. I've got to pour water. It says this, and they sit and watch me do the lab. I have over the years because I've been teaching the chemistry for JFK about 24 years now. I've worked very hard to build an outstanding curriculum for our children of Guam. I am the only high school that has this, and Ms. Bosaway has one with her. We've got in what's state-of-the-art. They're called lab pros. They're computerized. I don't know what you call it, handheld thing, that you put a graphing calculator on and you can put probeware into it, and the kids can do all kinds of labs. It's the state-of-the-art stuff.
What is probeware?
The food is the same, because I noticed that this is the way that you can't record the recorded transcripts cannot pick up what that is.
Okay.
Can you read it into the record?
Okay. They are called lab pros with graphing calculators.
Okay,
and probeware.
All right, and just for the record, when you said this a little earlier in your testimony, you were referring to that document, is that correct?
Yes.
Mr. A?
To the picture of it.
Present that document in the evidence, or is it just there for reference?
Just there for reference.
I just thought, she brought one so that you all could see what we have at JFK that we are not being able to use with our school.
Going back to that document, Ms. McMorrow, Ms. Penn, you want copies of that document? Or would you accept
it if we reference it? We don't need a copy.
Yeah, the testimony.
Thank you. Mr.
Avery. What is probeware?
Okay. It's the state-of-the-art. You know, like you have your phones and all these things, these badges that keep coming out, it's this state-of-the-art thing where it's like a computerized calculator with that. It's like the size of a calculator. And onto it, you put a graphing calculator, and you program the lab pro for how often you want it to take measurements and how many. And you attach probes to whatever you're measuring. In chemistry, we do a lot with temperature. Physics is other stuff. After they've done the lab, then they take the graphing calculator and they can go over to the computers and upload the data. And on the computers, I have a graphing analysis program that the children can then work with their data and make beautiful graphs and analyze and learn this.
Can you do this?
I'm just disappointed wondering. I apologize, Ms. Davis, to the internet because of the angle that you see that. I asked that if you're going to ask if the witness is going to, once again, all the parties, the witness is going to testify using any documents. I asked that they be shown first to the other parties. The one who is going to reference is that.
Are you able to use the probeware and the computer system that you just described?
No.
Why not?
At Keesman, my room is too small and I cannot set up with 14 computers and 5 printers that I have sitting and unused at the tomb on campus right now. There's no space for me to even put the tables up. I can't fit the students in with the desk and the lab stations that they put in.
On a scale
there's
of,
no internet.
On a scale of 1 to 10, considering the privations that you've enumerated so far in your testimony, on a scale of 1 to 10, give an educated guess if you can, to what extent the educational experience is being compromised in terms of chemistry for these students.
If I don't get the facilities that I need,
I can't do it.
I can take a book and I can teach.
With 10 being the total educational experience for chemistry, and 0 being nothing, on a scale of 1 to 10, to what extent has their chemistry educational experience been compromised by the lack of these things that we've discussed?
Tremendously, I'd say it's a 3. The quality of they're being tremendously shortcutted right now.
Getting back to the storage problem, do you remember the day that I came out there to the school when we first met? It seemed to me that I recall that there was dangerous acids being stored in an air-conditioned room right there. Is that correct? Or
at the moment, they're being stored in that manner at the JFK tomb on campus. But I need to move them, and I would like to move them over to the Keesman area, but there's no air-conditioned place. I cannot put that stuff in my classroom.
I just wanted to clear that up. Is there any other shortcoming that you haven't gone into that you can think of right now in terms of the teaching facility?
In terms of the student body and everything in general?
In terms of your classroom teaching experience there, is there anything else that the students are missing out on because of the lack of this or the lack of that?
I don't know. I guess I don't know quite what to say. I mean, I cannot function. That's the bottom line. It's like having a cardiologist on island that could do the, we had the machinery at the hospital for him to do the operations, and then we move him somewhere else, but we don't move the machinery and all the stuff he needs to do his job. I can't perform to the level that I want to give these children. They are severely being cheated, and I am so frustrated. I know I could retire today. I could go down and retire, and it's just like, I am tired of this. These children are our future. And I'm holy cursed, but I am so tired of this politicking and whatever else, money and greed. Let's get a school built that's proper for these children, for all the facilities, so we can teach these children what they need to know to function in the world today.
So the quicker we get the new facility, the better, would you say?
Oh, definitely. So we're going to sacrifice one generation, this year's students. They're not going to have the experience that the students had last year. The ones last year didn't get as much as the year before, because I was at JFK 2 years ago. And a student from now, just put this in, one of our students from JFK in Guam, he's now at the Naval Academy. Last year, when he graduated last year, he wanted to go to the Naval Academy. His math skills were weak, so they put him in the Naval Academy preparatory school to try to bring up his skills. I had his sister last year in my class, and he wrote a letter to his father and his sister, and he said, Mitchie, that's her name, the sister's name, you learn everything you can from Miss Fig and from Miss Beausoleil, because it's their two classes that are saving my, excuse me, butt here at this academy. And I'm very proud that now he is actually a freshman there at the Naval Academy. He was able to get through that preparatory school and get in because our classes gave him what he needed to survive.
Okay, Dana, thank you very much.
I'm sorry. I'm very emotional, I guess.
We understand, and thank you very much for coming here and explaining everything to us.
Okay. Never done this before.
Ms. Kane, do you have any comments?
No, thank you.
Mr. Flores, do you have any cross-examination?
Not really. I share your frustration, and I took a lot of chemistry myself. I wish you were my lab mate, because you sound like you know what you're doing. But
I graduated with honors from chemistry.
How many students are at JFK?
Pardon?
How many students at JFK?
This year I could not say for sure, but we usually have around anywhere from 2,300 to 2,600.
Okay, and I'm thinking that when you're talking about space then, because you mentioned Okadu. Okadu is about 154,000 square feet, has 1,200 students. You have how many at JFK again?
About 2,300, I don't
think.
So
almost twice as many. Yet the project that IBC is proposing is only 144,000 square feet. In fact, it's smaller than Okadu. So if we're going to have twice as many students on a smaller campus than Okadu, you might still not have enough space and might still not be able to meet your requirements to teach your students.
No.
I'm not just talking about the space issue.
At JFK Tumon, the only science rooms that were up in the main building were the chemistry and the physics. All the other science classes were down in the annex in the 10 classrooms down there.
Okay, because the argument here that we're bringing forth is not one of greed. It's the, we agree that the schools have to get open right away, and which is why we're trying to proceed this as quickly as possible. Ours is basically that the school that's being proposed by Deve is 236,000 square feet compared to 144,000 square feet, and is substantial. That's tens of million dollars less. In fact, on a recurring basis every year, $1.2 million less. That could be used to help your future.
Mr. Barnes, let me address you after some.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. And now, please proceed, Mr. Evans.
This question assumes facts, not in evidence, number one. Number two,
It assumes facts that are likely to be confidential in nature, but they definitely assume facts not in evidence and therefore should be stricken. Thank you.
Well, Ms. Ruder Forrest, okay, she hasn't answered your question, at least up there. I'm going to deny your motion to strike any testimony, as she's already stated the testimony in front of the attorney. However, I will grant Ms. Raven's motion to the extent that you have to ask a question on something that you brought up on direct. Okay?
Okay, I'm learning this as we go along. I'm not an attorney.
And then likewise, we're not here when we don't hear any of the merits. We're here solely for the substantial interest. So basically, ask a question, please, concerning any matter that this witness testified under direct examination by this agent. Do you understand that, Mr. Forrest?
Now I do, and therefore I have no questions, but I'd like to thank the witness for all she's doing for our students.
Thank you. Okay. I appreciate that.
Do you have no further questions?
Exactly.
Mr. Ravens?
Nothing else.
Okay.
Nothing further.
Nothing further.
Okay.
So, thank you, Ms. Dana. I think you have to read your emotions that you are very committed.
Yes, I am.
So, thank you very much. I think I know the family you were referring to. If I said sister, I would be referring to all the other people.
Oh, is that what you're saying?
When you spent the next few calls about languages, did you have an opportunity to view the chemistry lab at languages?
Yes, I went there. Both Ms. Bosley and I went there last year in September. There was a school day, it was a makeup day, I believe, and they had school and we didn't, so we went over because we wanted to see what the school looked like.
Have you had an opportunity to view some of the design and the layout of what the chemistry lab is?
Yes.
What is your opinion based on your experience of what the chemistry lab?
The room is a very nice size. It's bigger than the one even that I think I had at JFK in Tumon. What I did it like was the height of the lab tables, the little sinks, the small sinks, they have the counters, like the teachers here, the students are going in rows back that way at their lab stations instead of two straight rows. That makes it more difficult for a teacher to observe what everyone's doing, especially when they're using burners to see that everyone's, no one's going to have an explosion or get burned or a big ball of fire in their face. And so, I would prefer that they were straight in the line instead of the way they did it. Because the sinks are too small. They have no cabinetry. A typical chemistry classroom, you will have certain equipment that you store at your station, such as a ring stand, a burner, tongs, a glass wire gauze, iron rings, just a whole certain equipment that you just leave there because you're using it all the time. There's nothing to store in, which is very time consuming, and it's the same thing the tables they gave me for UPADU, at Keevan, because it means every time the students have to go get all these pieces of equipment, which is again more movement in the classroom, takes more time out of my 100 minutes for my students to do their lab and for us to discuss the lab afterwards. More chance for accidents to happen. You need to have cabinets. And when you go to college, you're going to have a drawer given to you with equipment that's locked, and you have to be able to take it, inventory at the end of the year. You have to show that you still have that equipment, or you pay for what you broke or what's not there. I'm not able to give that experience to my children, that responsibility, because every time we're going to have to pick up all the equipment and put it away and then bring it back out every time we're going to do a lab. Let's see what else. They have no hood system, no exhaust system at UPADU, and I was very concerned about that because when these students are learning to light burners, it takes them a while, the gas is going, and the fumes are building up, and that's not safe. And there's no system at UPADU, and I brought it up to the engineer, and she said, well, the air circulates in the building every so many seconds or something, and she said, I think that'll be sufficient. I said, I don't know. Tracy, the man, was that her last name? The one who was UPADU?
Cortex. Cortex, that's Ukudu, right? Whoever built Ukudu, she was the lead engineer over the whole project, over the whole thing. So I said at the time in our conversation, I don't know, but I said maybe you ought to go out to UOG and see what they have. I don't know if they have essential air, if they have hoods, but I think they have hoods in their labs. So there's no hood facility being prepared even at Teason right now for me for that.
What about the chemistry lab at GW and your several sessions? How was that experience?
Yes. Now, the problem there is that I was going back and forth between JFK Tumon and going up into the storerooms and having to carry things down for this lab, you know, the different things, drive it over, carry it to the classroom, do the labs, go back and forth getting stuff because I had no place to store stuff, although the kids did have cabinets, and we were able to store some of the main equipment in those drawers and cabinets because, as I said, GW was not using that area. I was able to do the labs there, except I couldn't do the computerized labs because they, too, had no computer stations. They didn't have the power to I could have even hooked up 14 computers if I brought them over.
Did you also have that ability?
They have internet in their classroom. I know the teacher last year, she herself was using a lot of PowerPoint stuff, but as far as computers in the classroom, she didn't have any that I saw when I was there that the students were actively using. They don't have this equipment. Only JFK does, because Ms. Bolsley and I have actively gone out and gotten grants and solicited donations and worked very hard over the years we've been there to build this program.
So how would you rate this, on your DevOps observation, how would you rate the design of the Ukudu chemistry lab?
And they know it's a good lab now. Now that they've put in this stuff, they put in the gas lines.
And they not had that thing before?
Not in the plans, the original plans. When I talked with them, they were already building the school, but they went in and they put them into the ground, into the flooring and stuff.
So you won't be satisfied with the design similar to
it? Yeah, I could live with that.
Mm-hmm.
But except, you know, there's some minor changes. As I said, the high school tables, I'd like cabinetry, and I want a hood system. I would like bigger sinks.
The reason why I'm asking that, because the design of the new JFK, and I'll just read from the section of the RFP, this is exhibit in the agency report, item number 26, says the chemistry and physics building design this building to mirror open chemistry and physics classes. So the JFK design is going to mirror OBU's design.
Okay, but I've talked with the architects and they know that I want the tables lined this way. They know I want gas. They know I need a hood system. Andy LaGuania was the one at the time that I spoke with.
Andy LaGuania was the representative?
Yeah, it was his own architectural firm. I understand it's his firm. He was being hired to do the plans for the drawings, I guess, for IBC. That was my understanding. Mm-hmm. And they came over and they took very detailed measurements because, you know, my cabinetry, we discussed it all, and the final last thing to me was, okay, we're going to give you the lab you want. We will design it in this manner, very similar to what I have at JFK because it's very functional.
All right. In essence, unless you have raised your concerns, the specifications do say that the design for the JFK is to be the design of both of you.
I haven't seen the design for what they're doing at JFK. As I said, the final thing I haven't seen. Just, you know, I have the assurances from the architect, and I spoke with Eunice about it a few weeks ago, and I said, well, can I just go over and meet with them now, and we look at the designs, but I guess they want to wait until everything's settled before they go any further with anything, so I haven't actually seen what they've done. I'm hoping they did what I asked, or I'll be blowing up about that.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so you're redirect explorers and golfers? You say?
Okay,
okay, you say you're exclusively witness, subject to recall and also admonishing to not discuss your testimony with any of the other witnesses or any of the proceedings are over. Thank you for sharing the information.
Now, when you say the proceedings are over, what does that mean?
Oh.
Like, when I leave with Ms. Boswade, we shouldn't be discussing what we testified. Okay.
Yes, until the proceedings have been reached.
Meaning the whole decision's been reached.
Well, they're here. Yes. Okay.
You can explain it. I just don't want to break the law.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Ms. Raymond, the next witness.
One further witness. Thank you.